Democrat Tim Ryan makes a big announcement, and Republican lawmakers vote to eliminate Ohio's four-day grace period for mail-in ballots. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Also on today's news review, a dispute over locker room damage at Indian Hill High School, Sinclair Broadcasting buys a bunch of stock in Scripps, and a new plan for empty parcels at the banks. Joining me now to get our weekly news review started is Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau reporter and producer, Joe Ingles. Welcome back, Joe.
Great to be with you, Lucy.
Well, it's great to have you here. I know you've been busy. Tell us about Tim Ryan. What was his big announcement today?
Well, you know, he's been talking for months that he may jump in the ring to run for governor. He even went as far as talking to see where support might be from other Democrats and setting up maybe a campaign, some funding for that. But then in the end, he has decided that he won't throw his hat in the ring. He said after careful consideration, prayer, and reflection with his family, closest friends, and advisors, he's made the decision not to run for governor in 2026.
Did this surprise you, Joe?
I actually was not surprised because I kept thinking, you know, why isn't he jumping in? Here's the thing, Lucy. Back in the winter, early this year, Dr. Amy Acton, a Democrat who is the former head of the Ohio Health Department, she threw her hat in the ring, and she has been going full force ahead all year long, campaigning throughout the state in various places, and she's been racking up key endorsements all along the way. And I kept thinking, you know, every month that goes on, every week that goes on, it makes it harder for anyone else to jump in because she's getting all the attention and sucking up all the energy in the room.
Sure. Does this mean there will not be a Democratic primary for governor?
Well, it sure doesn't look that way. There's always a Democrat or two that might jump in that might, you know, say, hey, we're going to challenge, you know, whatever. But as far as a major Democrat who has name recognition statewide, it certainly looks like Acton will be on her own.
What do you think took so long with Tim Ryan? Why, as you mentioned, Amy Acton's been campaigning since the start of this year, racking up these endorsements. He's been kind of coy about this for months. What do you think took so long?
Well, you know, he has been out of politics for a couple of years, and he's been working in as a lobbyist capacity for cryptocurrency and natural gas industries. And those two things might pose some problems with some Democrats. And the other thing is that if he went in, he would want to go in and probably run under the kind of message that he always had when he was running for Congress, which is, I am the working man's person. I stand for, you know, those working man values. And I think, you know, that's harder to do when you're aligned with who he's been aligned with for the past couple of years. Not impossible. He still could have possibly done that. But, you know, I think that, you know, he looked at everything around him. He looked at Acton. Also, there's been some unofficial polling. We don't really keep track of polling here so much, but there has been some polling that indicates that she's doing pretty well against Republican Vivek Ramaswamy, who is the apparent Republican nominee, will be going up against her next year. So, with all that under consideration, I think he just decided, you know, this is not his time.
Hmm. Well, we just talked about what won't happen. Let's talk about something that did happen in Columbus this week. State lawmakers approved a big change for Ohio residents who vote absentee by mail. Tell us what they did.
Well, they passed an election bill, and it includes several things, but the key thing that people were paying attention to was there is a four-day grace period right now. When you mail in a ballot, it has 4 days after the election to arrive at the Board of Elections and be counted. And so what lawmakers have done is they've wiped out that grace period. And basically on election night, all of the ballots will be in, except for there's a very narrow carve out for overseas and military voters. They get a little bit of time still, but pretty much all of the ballots will be in on election night, and you will see, and you know, where the election stands on that night. That's been something that at the federal level, President Trump has been talking about. He wants that. He wants to be able to have it determined on election night. And it looks like Ohio lawmakers picked it up and took it.
So is that why they made this change? Because of what President Trump wants? I think he issued some kind of executive order on this, didn't he?
He did. He did issue an executive order on it, and it plays very heavily in this Republican supermajority legislature. What President Trump wants is important. Plus, there's also the chance that there could have been a lawsuit from the federal government that had been indicated as well. So, you know, they were looking at all of those things together. But, you know, here's the thing. If you look at who's voting on mail-in ballots, a lot of those people are Republicans. A lot of those people are older folks who can't get out. And so, you know, the opponents of this say, you know, you're taking the very voters that would be most likely to vote Republican, and you're taking them out of the mix if their ballot doesn't arrive in time for the election.
Did Democrats raise any particular concerns about this? They're probably not worried about those Republican voters.
Well, they're not worried about the Republican voters, but they are worried about this, you know, taking away the opportunity for their voters, number one, and also the fact that this is like another chip. There has been a gradual erosion of some election conveniences, and this is another thing that they see as an erosion of election rights that have happened in recent years. And they're not happy about it. Also, there are some things in this bill besides the grace period for the ballots, for the mail-in ballots. There were also some ways that they're going after that could affect the voter rolls. For example, Democrat Kent Smith, who he was saying that he has in his area, there are four Kent Smiths, and one of them has passed away. And he said, you know where this is going? He said, these things can get confused. Someone can be mistakenly taken off the voter roll. And under this bill that they just passed, it would be hard for him to be able to vote, maybe impossible for him to be able to vote because he wouldn't have the time to be able to discover the problem and get it fixed.
Well, I know this passed both the Ohio House and the Ohio Senate. Has Governor Mike DeWine signed this? What has he said about this legislation?
Well, Governor DeWine has said in the past that he thinks that there really are no need to sign any more election restrictions. He says Ohio has a good election policy, that elections here are, you know, there's not the fraud. There's, you know, the situation is good. And he just doesn't want to sign any more election bills. But when asked about this one, he said, well, I'll take a look at it. So we really don't know where he stands exactly on this bill. But in general, he has signaled that he doesn't want to sign more election restrictions. Mm.
Well, another thing we've been following at the State House are all these bills related to property taxes. I know there's an effort underway to eliminate Ohio property taxes. If that constitutional amendment makes it to the ballot and if voters approve it, what would happen to the services that property taxes now fund?
Well, that's a very good question. That's a question that a lot of lawmakers are really looking at right now. We're seeing some bills that are under consideration that haven't passed, obviously, but they're under consideration that would deal with like safety forces that may lose money because of loss of property taxes. There's also another bill that would kind of overhaul school funding in a way that if property taxes went away, they could get funding. It would substantially change the way that that's done. But, you know, they're looking at that and they're saying, wait, you know, people are really mad about paying these property taxes and we must do something. So this past week, they passed four property tax bills that add up to about $2 billion in tax relief.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about this idea of lost property tax revenue that fund safety professionals, first responders. What's the bill that would deal with that?
Well, that's a bill that would basically take 20% of the state's portion of the sales tax, and it would fund safety forces, safety forces that are in the townships that maybe don't have a funding source if property tax goes away. So that bill is strictly for those safety forces. It would not allow for libraries or for schools or anything like that.
So it would take 20% of the state's share of the sales tax that Ohio collects. Do we know what that would mean for the state services or functions that are funded by that sales tax money currently?
Not fully. It's hard to get a real number on that. It could be that it could be that it's not dollar for dollar.
Hmm. Well, I know this is being proposed by Representative Ferguson. Does he think this should become law even if Ohio's property tax doesn't get eliminated?
Yes, he says that he thinks that this is a way that they can eliminate some, or at least relieve some property taxes. So he actually likes this idea, even if it's, even if it's not needed, even if the abolition of property tax doesn't come about, he still likes this idea.
Hmm. Well, I know there's another bill that would change the voter approval threshold for property tax levies. What would that do?
Yeah, that would take it up. Right now, it's a kind of a majority. That would take it up. Remember that bill we had, or actually it was a constitutional amendment we had on the ballot last year that said you'd have to have 60% to do another constitutional amendment. It's the same kind of idea. It would require a higher threshold for any kind of property tax to be able to be levied, so that you'd have to pass property taxes not by 52 or 53%, but it could go up to 60% and beyond.
What's the rationale behind that?
So that people are not, so that they want to make sure that there's widespread support for a property tax before it gets, when it's voted in, they want to make sure it's just not 50% plus. Hmm. They want to make sure there's widespread support for it because they, a lot of people are saying, it's not fair that, even if it's the majority, there's a whole lot of people out there who voted no on it, and they should be heard.
Huh. What kind of reaction has that proposal gotten from Democrats, from other Republicans?
Well, Democrats are, when they look at some of these proposals, the Democrats are saying, they want to do things like, for example, put a trigger on how much people would have to pay in property tax so that people who make less money would eventually hit a point where they wouldn't pay any more in property taxes. The Democrats kind of like expanding the tax, like homestead taxes, or expanding to certain populations the ability to either lower or get out of paying property taxes for people who are maybe older, low income, that sort of thing. That's where they focus their efforts on this.
Hmm. So they're probably maybe not fans of the 60% voter approval threshold for property tax levies?
Yeah. And, there may be some Republicans out there who aren't big fans of that either. This is all being worked out, honestly, right now. And we'll just have to see where it goes.
Yeah. Well, if this had been the law now, what would it have meant for school levies and library levies that were on the ballot earlier this month?
Well, there would have been some of them that wouldn't have been able to go into effect. But then there were a lot of them that passed by larger margins, too. So it just would have meant that those that were passed by smaller margins are the ones that would have been affected.
Okay. Well, I have been talking with Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau reporter and producer Joe Ingles. I know you've had a busy day, Joe. Thanks so much for your time today.
Well, thanks for having me, Lucy.
Up next, a locker room dispute after a high school football playoff game last weekend. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. A huge owner of TV stations across the country has bought millions of shares in the E.W. Scripps Company. Joining me now to discuss what it means and the implications for local TV news are Cincinnati Business Courier reporter Steve Watkins and WVXU media beat writer John Kieswetter. Welcome back, John and Steve.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lucy.
Steve, I want to start with you. I mentioned that we learned earlier this week Sinclair is the company that has bought several million shares of E.W. Scripps. How much did Sinclair buy?
Sinclair bought 8.2% of Scripps stock, which means they invested about $15.5 million to buy that stock, and they just bought it in the last 2 weeks.
Okay. Well, what does that mean? Is Sinclair trying to acquire Scripps?
Well, they are, and that purchase doesn't really get them very far, as you might guess, when you talk about 8% of the stock. What it does is kind of show that they're serious. And when a company buys, or an individual for that matter, if they buy more than 5% of the stock in a public company, they have to file with the Securities and Exchange Commission to let people and the market know, hey, we've bought a significant stake in this company. When Sinclair made their filing, they explained their reason for doing that and said, we've been in talks with Scripps to merge. We're still interested in merging. And they laid out a bunch of reasons involving market dynamics in the TV station ownership business that explain why larger scale, being a bigger company than either the two are on their own, is beneficial. So, yeah, they do want to acquire Scripps, but those talks broke off a few weeks ago, apparently in October, from what I was told. And so it remains to be seen if a deal will happen or not.
John, I know you've been covering the media scene here for a long time. If these two companies were to merge, or if Sinclair were to purchase Scripps, what would that mean for local TV news in Cincinnati?
I think eventually it would mean that to talk about the $300 million in cost synergies that Sinclair had said in their SEC filing, that you could see a situation like in Dayton and Columbus, where Sinclair operates the Fox affiliate, the ABC affiliate in Dayton and in Columbus, and there's one newsroom. And they have one anchor team. They have one set of meteorologists. It's a little different there because here you'd have an ABC affiliate and the CBS affiliate, which both has morning shows from 4:30 to 7 in the morning and also in the afternoon and then at 11 o'clock. When you have a Fox affiliate, you can do like have the morning show from 4:30 to 7, and then when Good Morning America comes on, you switch it to the Fox affiliate, and it goes a couple hours. And then at night, you get the 10 o'clock on primetime ends on Fox. So it would be a little different. But I know I've talked to some people at 12, and they know that the future of television is consolidation, and consolidation would mean eventually just one newsroom for two stations.
And that means job cuts, right? You can't combine newsrooms into one without cutting jobs.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, Steve, how has Scripps responded to this whole thing? Does Scripps seem, you mentioned that the talks kind of ended or the discussions were cut off in October. Does Scripps seem interested in this merger or this acquisition?
Yeah, I'm not sure if they're interested. They are interested in doing a deal, a transaction of some sort, because they see the same thing as what John just mentioned, that the future of the TV industry is consolidation and getting bigger. Sinclair is quite a bit bigger than Scripps also. Sinclair owns 178 stations around the country. Scripps owns 60. Scripps is pretty good size, and they own the ION network. But Sinclair is quite a bit bigger. So Scripps does say that they probably need to do a deal of some sort. But they said when they talked to Sinclair, they were not able to come to an agreement. They said actually Sinclair cut off the talks. But from the sounds of it, it sounds like they weren't matching up. And for what I've been told by an analyst, it sounds like there's a backstory to this, which is the Scripps family controls 93% of the voting stock in E.W. Scripps Company. They don't own that much equity in the firm, but the voting control lies almost solely with them. So if they don't want to sell, or if they don't want to sell to Sinclair, they don't have to.
So it's not like Sinclair could just buy so much stock that they could force this to happen.
That's exactly right. So, and that's why I said at the beginning that 8% stake, for one thing, it's not a huge stake, although it's significant. But in the way most companies operate, they could start to sway other shareholders and get enough votes to force a sale. But in this case, they have to sway the Scripps family. It's hard to say whether a deal between those two companies will take place. Scripps's CFO called some of the statements in the filing and that Sinclair did unnecessary theatrics. Mm. And he said, basically, if you want to resume talks, just pick up the phone. So for one thing, they don't sound very happy with Sinclair. But on the other hand, he's not saying we won't talk to you.
Yeah.
So. Well, stay tuned, as they would say in the TV business.
Go ahead, John.
Well, and also, you know, in recent months, Scripps has sold off a couple of stations. In October, they announced that they're selling their ABC affiliate, yeah, Channel 13, in Indianapolis. In September, they've announced that they're selling their Fort Myers-Naples station. And in July, they swapped six stations with Gray Media, another media company. Gray Media owns Fox 19, WXIX, here in town. So they, earlier this year, they've been, and in recent months, they've been willing to deal.
Hmm. Well, John, people who've lived in Cincinnati or around Cincinnati for a while remember the Cincinnati Post, the Kentucky Post, which Scripps owned for many, many years. Scripps is no longer in the newspaper business. That's no longer in the radio business. So what does the company have left? Is it just these dozens of TV stations that Steve mentioned?
I think that's about it, because they were started 147 years ago by Edward W. Scripps, E.W. Scripps. And so they're really a legacy media company, because they bought control of the Cincinnati Penny Post in 1883. Then they founded the Kentucky Post in 1890. In 1935, they got into broadcasting with WCPO Radio, 1230, now 1230 The Buzz. They actually put on Ohio's first TV station in 1947 up in Cleveland, WEWS, of all things. And then, you know, some people new to town might not realize that Scripps actually started the Food Network, and followed by Food Network and DYI. And then they spun that off into Scripps Interactive in 2008, and later that's now part of Discovery Warner Brothers. They sold off their newspapers in 2015. So I believe, Steve, you correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe all they've got left are TV, right?
Yeah, essentially it's those around 60 stations, and then TV networks. I mentioned before ION, and then they have several that are what's referred to in the industry as multicast, and it's essentially digital channels. They can be available on things like DirecTV and cable, but it's like Laugh and Grit and Bounce and some of those kind of things. They also have Scripps News. But yeah, it's either local TV stations or some of these networks.
So, John, what are you going to be watching for with this? What's next with this whole thing?
Well, you know, mergers are coming, and part of them coming this year was an indication that the Trump administration was willing to raise the cap. Right now, you can only have 30 TV stations that reach 39% of the mark of the households. And Nexstar, the biggest group, is trying to buy Tegna, the old Gannett properties. That's number four. So I think, you know, Sinclair is going to buy something and try to expand. And Scripps, being at number eight in the nation, a much smaller fish, it'd be interesting to see if they can hold out on their own with the family controlling it, or whether they get bought up by somebody else and we lose a legacy media company that in the city dates back almost 150 years.
Mm. What are you watching for, Steve?
Yeah, well, I was going to follow up on John's point. Pretty much the same. And John, you made a great point. I was going to say there are really two factors that are driving the timeliness of all this. One being, as you just said, John, the FCC has pretty much signaled that in the past there were limitations. You couldn't own two TV stations that are affiliated with the four major, any of the four major networks in a single market. In other words, Scripps and Sinclair combined could not, under those rules, own Channel 9 and Channel 12 here because they're both major network affiliates. But the FCC has indicated that that rule is apparently going away. They've basically said, if anybody wants to challenge it, just bring us a deal and we'll look at it. And they've indicated they would pass it. So the regulatory environment is more open to bigger mergers. And then the other thing is the market itself. John mentioned before, Scripps has sold two stations recently or agreed to sell them. The prices that they got are really good, and that's just the way the market is now. So pricing is good, so Scripps could sell at probably a higher price than they could have, let's say, a year ago, and maybe in 2 or 3 years they might not get that price. And the regulatory environment is good, so it kind of fuels the fire for some of these deals. So, yeah, I would look for Scripps to do something relatively soon in the next several months. And who knows? It's hard to say what, but those are definitely factors to watch.
Okay. Well, I have been talking with Cincinnati Business Courier reporter Steve Watkins and WVXU Media Beat writer John Kieswetter. Thank you both for your time today.
Thanks for the invitation.
Welcome. Thanks, Lucy. Thanks for having me.
Now we're going to turn to this story that I mentioned earlier, this Taft and Indian Hill High School's playoff game. They went head-to-head last Friday in a football playoff game, but the final score has been overshadowed by a dispute over some locker room damage. Joining me now to explain is Cincinnati Enquirer reporter David Ferrara. Thanks for being here, David.
Good afternoon, Lizzie.
Welcome back. So first, what was the score? Who won?
Well, the Indian Hill Braves won. They continued their undefeated record into the playoffs. And it was a tense game. And that's kind of what led to this emotional response that a lot of people had after the game, is because you have two undefeated teams going at it in the playoffs. And there were some calls that, of course, you know, people always turn to the refs and make a comment about penalties here or there. But there were some calls that people found questionable that led to this sort of tense environment.
Well, let's talk about the big story has been what did or didn't happen in a locker room at Indian Hills. What can you tell us about all that?
Right. So Taft was playing at Indian Hill High School. And after the game, it was reported that there was some damage done in the visitors' locker room that Taft had been using their football team at Indian Hill. And it sort of began with some pictures that began circulating around social media where you see these large holes of drywall damage and drywall on the ground. And it looked like somebody might have kicked or punched the wall and caused some damage in some way. And then there were TV reports that began to come out and that circulated that had statements from both the Indian Hill athletic director and Cincinnati Public Schools that acknowledged the damage and said that it happened following or during the game, supporting alternating each.
Was there damage in the visiting locker room before the game?
Well, that's the question of the hour. And in the initial statements that were given, it indicated Indian Hill had said that there was damage sustained during the game. CPS had said there was damage following the playoff game. So it seemed to indicate that the damage was done by Taft High School. However, there was a video that was taken by a Taft player that had all the students setting up in the locker room. And you could actually see some drywall damage in the background. And this was taken prior to the game. So there began a sort of discussion about, well, wait, there was already damage there. And why is it immediately being pinned on us?
So do we have a clear sense for whether there was more damage done during or after the game, or how much more it was? Is any of that clear right now?
Right. So as far as the latest information that we know, the superintendent for Indian Hills district said that there is some damage that was there prior to the game, but that there was additional damage sustained. And the extent of that damage is still unclear, because as far as the security, which was a Indian Hill police officer, had noted in an incident report that there were large holes kicked and punched into every piece of the drywall, the drop ceiling had been damaged, garbage on the floor. So it's unclear what was there prior to Taft High School coming in versus them coming in after. But they did concede that there was some damage that had already been present.
Okay. What has Cincinnati Public Schools school superintendent Shauna Murphy said about all this.
Well, the CPS superintendent, Shauna Murphy, she came out and she said that the district wants a full investigation. You know, Taft had a good season. They had a good year. And if there was some damage that was done by one or two football players, she doesn't want that to be taking down the whole reputation of the school and the whole team. So she wants more information before there's any sort of agreement that we're going to be, that CPS would be paying for the damages. They want to make sure that, okay, this hole was there, this was not, and all that before there's just a blanket agreement of, okay, we're going to cover all that.
Yeah. Okay, so we've got Indian Hill High School. Taft High School was visiting the visiting team at Indian Hill. There's been criticism circulating online about how the media has covered this story. There's been some of the criticism has accused the media of being inaccurate, divisive. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of it started with members of Taft saying that, you know, the damage was already there and they had the video that came out and that sort of added more fuel to the flame of, hey, look, we have evidence that the damage is already there, even though we already knew that. And especially as people on social media and then TV reports started to come out that indicated, okay, Taft was the one who did the damage without having this additional video, a lot of people felt like that people, that the community was jumping to conclusions that it was Taft. And David Whitehead, who's the Cincinnati NAACP president, actually released a statement yesterday morning saying that it was taken far out of proportion, that the TV station should have done a little more vetting prior to releasing these stories and just going off of the statements that were released. And that especially how people were responding in comment sections on a lot of these reports and jumping towards accusations and honestly racist comments towards Taft High School, that it just escalated far out of control.
And I guess we should note that Taft High School is in the city of Cincinnati, and most of the players are black students, and Indian Hill is in the suburbs, and most of their players are white students. So was that part of this whole racialized situation that people are talking about?
I do think so, especially in the past few days, as I was speaking with different folks that have strong opinions on this. You know, CPS board president, she had made a statement saying that, you know, what's unfolded has become, you know, a disappointing reaction to what should have been a good game and a cap off to a good season, but that it has become a racialized and divisive news cycle, she said. And as you mentioned, right, Taft is a, you know, 89% black African-American school, Indian Hill 74% white. So you have two largely different demographics. And especially as things start to carry out on social media, there has been a lot of comments, both from Whitehead and from the CPS board president, that have indicated that that might be a factor.
Well, what's next with this? Are the two school districts going to work together on trying to sort through all this?
Definitely. So they did have the Indian Hill School District did have one of their police officers come and review the damages, but it was purely for documentation. They're not pressing any criminal charges. They want to handle this internally, to the point to where we've heard some statements come out, such as from the superintendent and from the board president, but we haven't heard a lot of indication on what that's going to go and how that's going to look in terms of if there's going to be discipline against the students or if what the damages are actually going to be quoted at. They do seem like they want to handle this internally.
Is that initial police report what kind of triggered the stories and things, do you think? Or do you have any idea of those initial stories?
My understanding is it started with the photos that were circulating on social media. And, you know, as you see these photos where you see visible damage, and then the athletic director for Indian Hill, as well as the CPS spokesperson, confirmed that there was damage and that it happened following or during the game, depending on the statement. It indicated that, okay, here's the damage, here's the story. It seemed plain and simple done. But as that additional video came out on social media showing there was damage ahead of time, then it became, well, wait, maybe there's more to this.
I see. Okay. Well, I guess we will see how the school districts work together and come to a resolution. I have been talking with David Ferrara, Inquirer reporter. Thank you so much for being here today. We always appreciate having you in the studio.
Thank you, Lissy. Happy to be here.
Up next, a new plan for Cincinnati's riverfront. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. This week, the public got its first look at a new plan for Cincinnati's riverfront, and Cincinnati City Council voted to purchase property near a possible site for a proposed arena. Joining me now to talk about all of this is Cincinnati Inquirer City Hall reporter Scott Wortman. Welcome back, Scott.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Well, thanks for being here. Let's start with this property. Cincinnati City Council voted to buy a vacant property this week. Tell us where it is and how much it costs the city.
It's in the West End. It's actually right by your former digs where public radio used to be, WCET still is. It's behind Music Hall, near also the TQL Stadium. In the middle of all this, it's the former Free Store Food Bank site. They moved from there, so it's been vacant for a bit. But the city is putting up $4 million for the port to buy it and hold on to it. They're saying it's for any future development. They just said it's an important piece of property. But it also happens to be one of three top sites being looked at for a potential new arena that a lot of business owners are pulling for.
Well, I know FC Cincinnati had an option to buy that land or that property from Free Store Food Bank. How did the city end up getting involved?
Well, what city council members told me that FC Cincinnati officials suggested that the city buys it. And then under this scenario, this allows the city and the port to then make whatever investments need to be done to it infrastructure-wise. And it also, we don't have really a time frame for any development, be it an arena or otherwise. So this allows the port to hold on to it for whatever it may be used for.
So you mentioned that this is near one of the preferred locations for a new arena to replace the one that's on the riverfront now. Does this mean the city favors that spot for a new arena?
There's no official policy citywide, but I mean, a lot of the council members and the mayor have come out publicly in support of a new arena. Now, how it gets paid for, I mean, obviously that's the big detail that has to be worked out. No one's really seriously put forth a plan yet for that. But the mayor is very public that he does want an arena. He did say when the city voted to purchase this that, you know, how that's paid for and where it goes is to be determined, but they definitely want an arena. I mean, it's a big need in this city with, I mean, I'm not personally advocating it myself, but business leaders definitely are not happy with the current arena situation with Heritage Bank. It's old, built in the 70s. They say that our lack of a new arena keeps us from getting a lot of events like the World Cup and a lot of conventions that bypass the city because we don't have an arena.
Will this property that the city bought or, you know, earlier this week near our old location and where WCET is located now, what else could be developed there on this old Free Store Food Bank property if it's not part of an arena plan?
Well, they haven't proposed anything specifically, but council members I talked to, and I believe the mayor even also said, it could be housing, it could be entertainment, whatever the market dictates. The argument, if it isn't an arena, the argument for the city purchasing this is just the fact that it's on the border with Over the Rhine, downtown, and West End, so it's very centrally located, and they didn't want an out-of-town speculator building who knows what there.
Mm-hmm. Well, we mentioned that this is one of the top three sites for an arena or next to one of the top three sites. What other sites are being considered for the arena? What are the other two that are kind of in the running?
Well, one of the top ones that was singled out in a study, I believe it was earlier this year or late last year. Time's hard to keep track of these days. But one of the top sites, because there's just a lot of space there and it's still close, is on the Queensgate downtown border, somewhere near I-75. That just by virtue of it being centrally located near the river and having a lot of space, that was very desirable among people planning this. And another one, although this would be a very tight fit, is by the Hard Rock Casino over in that end. But according to the study that was released, that was the third choice of the three. And then this one here by TQL Stadium and the old public radio location.
Okay. Well, let's move south to the riverfront. Tell us about this new vision unveiled for the banks. Would it fill all the empty blocks that are down there now?
Well, that would be the plan. Could take up to 10 years or so, depending, you know, again, on the market and whether the city and county can get along. But there are five main undeveloped portions of the banks, which opened and began in 2011, there are still five big parcels that don't have anything on them yet or have parking on it. The biggest one being Lot 24. Over the years, like 7 years ago, there was a giant mixed-use development proposed for that. Never came off the ground when COVID hit, and this has kind of been vacant ever since. There are just a bunch of pylons and an empty garage space there right now. But planners that were contracted by the county presented before both the county commissioners and the city council this week, saying they want to shoot for getting mixed-use residential, about 800 to 1,200 residential units, and a mix of entertainment and office space on these five remaining lots.
How tall?
What that would be exactly remains to be determined. But they were like proposing about 12-story high-rise buildings, basically.
Okay. So that's taller than what's down there. Is it 12 stories or even more? Is that taller than what's down there now?
It's taller than what's down there now. They said that getting much higher than that, like up to maybe 24 stories, but getting much higher than that, developers started bulking because just that's a lot of office space. And that's, been kind of a dicey market since COVID.
Sure. Was there any information in these presentations about how much these apartments, if they're apartments in the housing or condos, if they're condos in the housing, would either rent for or sell for?
Yeah, I didn't hear that. I mean, there was a lot of information out there, but I think that's a bit premature at this point. I think they're market rate. But
so not talking about affordable housing?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay. So you mentioned mixed use. What else would be developed aside from the housing? Is it office space, like you said? Is there other stuff that would be part of this?
Yeah, the specifics still have to be ironed out, but there'd also be a hotel, 100 to 150 room hotel, and about 60 to 80,000 square feet of retail and entertainment space. What would go in there, though? I mean, that's something that would, depend on, who it attracts.
Sure. How much would it cost to build this whole thing, and how long could it take?
Well, they said about 10 years. I didn't hear an actual budget because, at this point, what goes in there is to be determined. So the cost would be something that would be part of the development process.
Okay. Well, the banks has been a collaboration of the city and the county for many years. You referenced that some of this is dependent on how well the city and the county get along. How did county commissioners react to this plan?
Well, that was the most interesting part about this. The city and the county had two completely different reactions to this. When it went before the city council, the city council members were very enthusiastic about it. And they wanted, the higher, the taller the buildings, the better. Councilman Seth Walsh said the developers should not be afraid of heights. They didn't like the current, like how small the buildings currently are on the banks. They say it doesn't fit with the whole downtown aesthetic. And basically, the council members want more residents downtown. I mean, that's been the big struggle. The big challenge downtown for the last, several decades is getting more people to live down there. The commissioners, on the other hand, were much more hesitant. They, even Stephanie Sommereau-Dumas and Alicia Reese, even kind of questioned whether it should be a priority, how important really it is to develop these other lots. Like they said something should go in there, but whether now is the right time. Commissioner Denise Driehaus questioned whether the buildings were too large, so did Commissioner Reese. But they seem far less enthusiastic about it than the city council.
Well, and it sounds like anything that's built along these lines down there would need public investment. I mean, the city and county paid a lot of money for the garages and some of the street work and that sort of thing down there. So it's not going to be like it's a freebie for the city and the county if this happens.
That is correct. And they don't have the specific figures on this because that, again, remains to be determined what actually gets built because nothing's been decided yet. This was just the preliminary. We want the planners wanted the city officials' input, and then they're going to present something, a development update plan to go before both the city council and county commission sometime early next year. No date or month has been like set yet, but that is the big question. How much of this is going to cost? That'll be determined later, but it does need both the city and the county to approve it. And if one doesn't approve it, then nothing happens.
Well, so you mentioned that the city and the county will see an updated version of this plan in early 2026. I know you said no specific date's been announced. What else is next with this, where there'll have to be zoning changes if they approve this? I mean, what would the next steps be?
I mean, that would be the plan, the updated plan, the way it was described to me, is a zoning change, basically. The city would approve the zoning for that area, and the county has to sign off on it because, I mean, what governs the banks is like this patchwork of, you know, 25 years worth of development agreements, leases with the two sports teams. But basically it requires both, because the county owns like the air rights there and the land. So it requires both to approve it, but the city does have to approve a zone change, which is all wrapped into this. It's technical, but it's all wrapped up into this plan amendment that'll go before both entities early next year sometime.
Okay. And I assume members of the public will get a chance to say what they think at some point, huh?
That would be generally how it should work. So they haven't, again, set anything up, but I'm sure there will be some public hearings.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Inquirer City Hall reporter Scott Wortman. Thanks so much for your time today, Scott. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.